Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome, everyone, to today's episode of New Books Network. Today, we have Sudhev Seth, the author of Bankrolling Empire, with us. And I'm Origno, your host. And I have with me Brittany Puller as my co-host for today's session of New Books Network. Welcome, Sudhev. Welcome, Brittany.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you. Okay, so let's talk in a little about Dr. Sudhev Seth. He's a senior lecturer of international studies at the Lauder Institute at University of Pennsylvania, where he teaches perspectives on entrepreneurship, global capitalism, and leadership. He also holds an appointment as senior lecturer in the Department of History at the University of Pennsylvania. His research focuses on the social and cultural history of South Asia, business history, and family enterprise in societies past and present. Prior to joining Penn, he was at the Harvard Newcomen Fellow in Business History at Harvard Business School, where he taught in MBA and doctoral programs. Dr. Seth received his PhD in History and South Asian Studies from the University of Pennsylvania and his MA from Jawaharlal Nehru University in New Delhi. He holds an undergraduate degree from the University of Chicago at Berkeley, where he studied music, politics, and languages. I have to say, too, he's published widely across the field of South Asia, as well as Economic and Political Weekly, Journal of Economic and Social History, and Manuscript Studies as well. But Bankrolling Empire is his first book. We'll be talking about this in detail today. And I have to say, it's his incredible contribution to South Asian studies in multiple fields. It's a monumental book, and it covers multiple areas, thinking from moneyed history to political transformations in South Asia, thinking about financiers and how we think about capital in South Asia and across the world. I just want to say this is an excellent book. I'm looking forward to digging in today.
Absolutely. So today's Seth's book, Bankrolling Empire, explores how a prominent family business from 17th century India navigated political uncertainty across generations to expand their entrepreneurship and shape state power into modern times. And like Brittany mentioned, it's an extreme rich book that goes back and forth business history and political history. So we'd like to hear a lot more about that. And so the family that Sudhev Seth talks about, featured in the book, is now in their 15th generation. That's amazing. Record across the centuries. And the family is recognized as one of Asia's largest manufacturers of textiles and fast fashion today. So on that note, we would like to get started with the questions and see where this interview goes. So Sudhev, welcome. So can you tell us a little bit about your career, how it unfolded, and from your days in Jawaharlal Nehru University across navigating different disciplines, and ending up teaching at Wharton, which is what we want to hear a little bit about. So could you tell us the unfolding of intellectual trajectory?
Sure. Even before New Delhi, I must start with my undergraduate years at UC Berkeley in California. I grew up in the Bay Area, and like most South Asian migrants and their children, I was basically told that education is a very important part of one's being. And if making it to a good university like Berkeley, why not study something like medicine or engineering or some of the more robust professions with very clear career prospects? Well, my first semester at UC Berkeley, I was very open to all kinds of courses, and I ended up taking Music of India with Professor Bonnie Wade, who went on to become my undergrad advisor and was a wonderful mentor, and a course in Hindi language. And to my delight and to my surprise, my parents were very supportive of my choices in terms of what I studied at Berkeley. So as each semester progressed, I took more and more language courses, and I took more and more courses in South Asia studies more broadly. By the end of my graduation, I was prompted by two very wonderful and thoughtful professors, Munis Faruqi and Vasudha Dalmia, that if I was truly interested in studying India, making short-term trips would not suffice. I would have to go and live and study and spend years in India, imbibing all that it had to offer. So that's what prompted me to sort of reverse migrate and go from California to New Delhi, where I pursued a master's degree at JNU. At JNU, I was also greeted by a wonderful set of professors, I can't name them all, but just to give you a sense, Professor Najaf Haider, Janaki Nair, Niladri Bhattacharya, and so many other young faculty members who were so influential in teaching me the basic tenets of modern and medieval South Asian history. Once I finished my degree at JNU, which involved a lot of travel, a lot of archival digging, and just really being present in a society which had very strong and opinionated views on history, I decided to continue further study at the University of Pennsylvania. At Penn, I developed several ideas, one of which I took to its logical conclusion, which was the dissertation. And I ended up writing a dissertation that tried to understand how historical transition takes place in South Asia. I can say a bit more about that, but really the bedrock of that research goes into this first book, which we will discuss shortly. Long answer short, in terms of how I ended up back at Penn, when you're looking for a job as a graduate student, you're just grateful for whatever falls into your purview. And I was very lucky that I was offered a position at Harvard Business School. It was actually a business history postdoc fellowship. HBS has a long history of having historians on the faculty, and spending a year there really transformed my thinking and my teaching abilities. So at the end of that year, when I had a few other offers, the offer back at Wharton felt very challenging and very interesting, and in many cases also unconventional. It was a position that allowed me to teach across the School of Arts and Sciences and the Business School. And what can be more exhilarating than trying to convince a group of people who are not attuned to history, the merits of studying history, and all that is possible when you do historical inquiry. So that's how I ended up back at the University of Pennsylvania, and I'm very happy to be back in Philadelphia, a city that I love very much.
Wonderful.
Wonderful. So let's start talking about the book a little bit, and I find it really fascinating because you lead us through this long durée history in multiple generations over hundreds of periods, and you actually lead us through the lens of a family, and it's a single family, the Jalaris. But how did you come across them in your fieldwork and decide to use them to kind of tell the story?
So actually, if you look at the book closely, there are two families that are featured in the book, and the Hari Bhakti family, which is involved in the second half of the book, really became my entry point into thinking about political power and private capital. And I must thank Professor Samira Sheikh, who teaches at Vanderbilt, who guided me early on, because she said, you know, when I was a student at MS University in Baroda, I vaguely remember a room full of documents that had not really been looked at. But I believe and I suspect there's a lot that can be done with these materials. And these are banking papers. Why don't you go have a look at them? So in 2014, equipped with a small amount of money from Penn as a development grant, I ended up spending 10 to 15 weeks in India in the summer looking at this material. Well, what I learned by looking at this material is that local banking families were very much involved in state power and building of state capacity. And in this particular case, the Hari Bhakti family was involved in the early political aspirations of the Gaikwad household, which is the princely state of Baroda. Now, what I hadn't figured out yet was whether similar families existed prior to that period. And a lot of digging and a lot of ethnographic field work and archival work eventually turned up the role of this family, the Jhaveri family. And so I spent much more time in Ahmedabad city where this family operated, and I was able to identify a range of materials that started to fill in the gaps of what happened between business and politics in an earlier period. So in some cases, you end up starting in a place, and as you start doing your research, you realize, wait a minute, there are more interesting materials and there's a story to be told either for a later period or for an earlier period, depending on where you are. So in my case, it was pushing the story back further in time. But the initial gateway was the Hari Bhakti family in Baroda, which became sort of the entry point for me to think about business and capital relations with the state.
That is extremely helpful. And yeah, we will delve later into how that kind of frames your book in terms of how it transitions to state power, which I think is a crucial running thread. Speaking of multiple threads, the historiography is incredible. and it's also pretty distinct. And I would like to touch upon a little bit and want you to like speak on it. So you mentioned that you're contributing to a growing scholarship on global merchant economies and the household, as Brittany mentioned. So this is something and you discuss this more in the conclusion and segments in the book. So I want to hear a little bit on what this global merchant history in the household is. And within the book, we noticed that you're covering like three major strands of South Asian historiography. So there's the literature on the Mughal decline, the relationship between commercial agents and the state, and the nature of the Mughal state as a bottom-up and, in quotes, processual one, as you mentioned. So I would like to take your time to touch upon these two segments of extremely fascinating historiography.
So let me take that question in two parts. The first question around merchant economies and histories of the household really is a fancy way of saying that we have been very attuned to historical sources and evidence base that emanates from mature state archives. And one of the steps I've tried to take, both in my dissertation but also now in the book, is try to pluralize the kind of materials that we're using to think about historical change. And so I have found histories of merchant economies and histories of household as a useful way to think about unique, robust, and diverse materials that are emanating from non-state repositories or non-state actors. And so in my case, what I found really interesting is that although the Hari Bhakti materials, for example, speak a lot about Gaikwad state power, they're not documents produced by Gaikwad bureaucrats or bureaucrats involved as employees of the princely state. So that's sort of one way of thinking about it, is how can we pluralize the range of materials? And there have been a range of works emanating from other parts of the world. If you think about Jessica Goldberg's work on merchants in Europe, if you think about Francesca Trovellato's work on Jewish merchant networks, and a whole range of scholars who've tried to pluralize their fields by looking at these, I don't want to call them esoteric archives, but really archives that have escaped our purview. They've been able to tell really interesting stories about not only state power, but human activity more broadly. So for me, this has been an inspiration to say, can we do something similar for South Asia? We have really robust stories of state power, but what about those associated with the state or allied with the state, or in some cases not allied with the state? What can we learn by looking at those materials? The second part of your question about historiography is quite an interesting one. You know, I have to confess, when I was in graduate school, I was disciplined very nicely by my advisors, and rightfully so, that you must ground your observations in existing literature. And I was always reluctant to do that, maybe because I was afraid to do that, or maybe because I felt like I didn't have the skills. But I think it was very helpful to situate my thinking in scholarship that was robust and that existed. So you rightly pointed out the literature on Mughal decline, the relationship between commercial agents and the state, and really thinking about the nature of state power as a processual one. These are the three areas that I identified as areas I wanted to work on. Now, as I started to organize my thoughts around these areas, I felt that the materials that I was looking at, the Javeri materials especially, was allowing me to tell a different type of story. So to give you an example for each of the three historiographies that you outlined, the literature on Mughal decline has been extremely active, and I'm not saying that it's entirely wrong or that we should dismiss it. All I'm saying is that the existing literature has done a lot to shed light on some crucial aspect of Mughal deterioration, right? So some examples include, oh, the Mughals were involved in too much conspicuous consumption, and this is why the state atrophied. Other arguments look at personality traits of emperors, such as Aurangzeb, for example, as a reason for why state affairs were neglected, causing the downfall of the Mughal Empire. And other theories, including the most robust one offered by Irfan Habib, the doyen of Mughal history, was that peasant revolt in the countryside really targeted Mughal centers of power and caused its atrophy. Now, each of these, I feel, have a lot of merit to them, And my goal was just to add one more element to the conversation. And my element was the role that expansionary wars in the Deccan played in weakening existing Mughal strongholds. So I think this book really does, I don't want to say a great job, that's for the reader to say, but really makes an earnest effort to look at how happenings in other parts of empire actually start impinging on existing strongholds in Gujarat, the province that I look at. So it's really a story about how, you know, we have to look at a much more plural landscape in trying to assess regional change. You know, you can't just look at one region to assess regional change because you're not taking into consideration its connections to other parts of the subcontinent. Now, as far as commercial agents in the state, this is also an area that has elicited much conversation. And simply put, what I tried to do is try to show the contours of this relationship between state power and financial agents over time. So rather than do a synchronic snapshot of what it looks like at any given moment, I've sort of tried to take on the challenge of explaining this change over 200-300 years. And what I've learned, without giving away the punchline, which I think you might ask me about later, is this relationship does change over time, and we have to be attuned to those changes over time. And finally, the issue of Mughal state as processual. This is something that I'm not the first one to say, but I've been really inspired by writers like Sanjay Subramaniam, Muzaffar Alam, Farhad Hassan, a range of amazing historians who've come before me, who I've really taken cues from. And essentially, in this volume that Sanjay Subramaniam and Muzaffar Alam published in 1998, when I was just 10 years old, believe it or not. So this historiography was already advanced when I was a child. Little did I know that I would actually go into this field. But thanks to writers like that, they've laid out a beautiful agenda for our young people to say, look, we have relied on mature state sources. We've relied on Persian materials largely. How about we find ways to pluralize the field and see what insights emerge from that? So they're the first to sort of call younger historians to arms and say, can you find ways to make this field more interesting? Can you study a range of languages outside of Persian or in addition to Persian to help fill in the gaps? And so I've tried to do that in my work. And what I've learned is that, at least in Gujarat, Mughal state power was concentrated at certain nodes, namely urban centers and areas where they had robust control over trade routes. And decline of the Mughal Empire also takes place at those nodes. So these nodes, places like Ahmedabad, Surat, Baroda, Cambay, and even a few small towns along the way, really become sites for power tussles and power struggles. And for me, looking at these nodes has been really enriching and quite rewarding.
Thanks.
Thank you. That was incredibly helpful to flesh that all out for us. To just kind of dive in a little bit and talk a little bit more about the financiers and money classes in your book. And you talk about how they have this relationship with the political lead in Gujarat over time. So can you describe that relationship and how it evolved the changing political landscape of Gujarat?
That's a great question. So what I like to say is that when you're looking at a historical period or a set of materials, you tend to think that your own materials and your own start and end point is some kind of hermetically sealed universe, and that what you're describing is only unique to that set of decades or that set of centuries. I want to start by saying that that is not necessarily the case. So for those who are working on the period prior to me, also looking at Gujarat, people like Samira Sheikh, who I mentioned already, and there is a range of amazing scholars who've come before me, have started to think about this relationship between the merchant classes and state power already. And so I want the readers to know that, you know, there is already some discussion around that. What we've learned from their work is that typically financial activities were outsourced to specialists. In the case of Gujarat, largely Jain families who were involved in the buying and selling of bullion and the minting of coins on behalf of sovereigns. So we know this, for example, even during Firoz Shah Tughlaq's period, which was earlier than the Mughal period, we have evidence documenting the role of Jain families in state affairs as related to money matters. Now, what we can learn from that is that largely the state may not have had the capacity or may not have had the interest to funnel state resources for those activities, and it was much more efficient to outsource them or to farm them out to specialist groups. My story really begins with the conquest of Gujarat by Akbar. And what I suggest is that by the late 16th century, and certainly by the early 17th century, Akbar's conquest of Gujarat generates a kind of centripetal pull where merchants, traders, people of religion, artisans, and many other specialists are drawn to Ahmedabad as a place where they can build their entrepreneurship, find employment, and find a market for where their services and goods will be appreciated. So the Javedis are no different. They migrate from Rajasthan, from a place called Osai, which is a temple pilgrimage town in dry, arid Rajasthan, and they migrate their way to Ahmedabad seeking more opportunities. The early members of this family, we know, are involved in the jewelry trade, and it is quite possible that Shantidas Javedi, the founding patriarch that I focus on, who was born in 1580 approximately and lives until about the mid-17th century, is also trained in gemology and the art of buying and selling jewels. It is this skill that ingratiates him to Mughal elites, who, by the way, are fond of fine jewels and gems. So they themselves want to purchase these goods from Shantidas Javedi, and he becomes close to Mughal sources of power. This initial phase I document as courtly mutualism. It's a phase where elites require the services of merchants, not only in terms of running the money market and minting their coins and providing loans to people in the market, but also as people who are selling precious commodities to the court itself. These are commodities that court elites want, not only for conspicuous consumption, which we all know very well, but also as repositories of storing wealth. So when you have a really nice piece of jewelry, it's not just because it looks nice, but it's also a kind of movable asset that you can transfer into coin, or that you can use as collateral when time calls for it, right? So this initial phase, courtly mutualism, is where these elites come together and start having conversations with one another. And for their part, the business elites also want to be recognized as preeminent merchants, as purveyors of top goods, as people who can provide things that the court likes. And so we have records documenting this relationship, and I can say more if you desire, but I'll stop there and sort of let you take the conversation forward.
I think that's a perfect point to bring out the divisions of the chapters through the themes, and one of which you just touched upon. So it's the schematic of the book is really interesting. It is temporal, but you mentioned there is courtly mutualism, there's political commensalism, expedient extortion, interestingly, and there is competitive coparcenary. So and people would find, no doubt, find this fascinating, but I would like you to, one, tell us what went behind chapterizations to spell it out in this way. And second, I feel there's a commentary on the transformation of state through these four themes. So I'd like you to touch upon these two when you can.
Very nice question. So when we're thinking about a book level argument, or we're thinking about a narrative arc, and you're trying to organize your materials in a way that's digestible to the larger public, for me, this was a big challenge. I thought to myself, how am I going to convey and convince those who are outside of my field even to not only read the book, but also find something of value and interest in it? And so for me, I took a step back and I tried to map out the broad contours of the relationships that I was seeing. So why I thought of it this way was because I'm sort of a non-traditional economic historian. When you think of economic history, you think of someone working on a large data set and running all kinds of regressions and coming up with some kind of quantitative argumentation that is convincing. Well, unfortunately for the Mughal Empire, and especially for the earlier period, we just don't have that range of quantitative data or the velocity of that kind of data. And so for me to sit down and do simple regressions would have been almost meaningless, right? So financial relationships and economic relationships is really what I was trying to uncover or discover. And as I tried to map the overarching arc of the book, I thought to myself, if I'm trying to understand relationships, why not use a kind of heuristic to think about how these relationships have changed over time, which is how I identified these four phases. These four phases are largely ones that document a relationship between purveyors of capital, or those who you might call merchants, and those who are in the business of making and breaking states. So I want to make sure that we're clear about that. This is not some kind of definitive marker, or this is not some kind of set in stone description. It's largely a way for me to capture a relationship that I see across time. And yes, it does map onto changing contours of state power. Shall I break it down briefly and tell you what each of these four are? Great. So as I mentioned, courtly mutualism is largely the idea that the Mughal state provided a kind of world where merchants were invited into and benefited from state power in a bunch of different ways. First, they benefited as being under the protection of the state. So their trade routes and their merchandise was protected by Mughal governors. They benefited from the state in that the state purchased goods and commodities that they wanted to sell. They benefited by being offered titles and recognition from state leaders in terms of reinforcing their local position as elite merchants. And because this mutualism ought to have worked both ways, I say that the Mughal state also benefited. The Mughal state benefited not only by having a conduit through which they could purchase beautiful commodities, but by having a local merchant family that was in favor of Mughal rule that sang its praises in the locality. It is also very important to have this in a world that is largely, you know, it's connected, but it's also disconnected. Remember that it takes 2 to 3 weeks to travel from a place like Delhi to Gujarat. So to have a merchant family that is locally based, that is supportive of Mughal rule, is very, very important. And a few other things. So this first phase is mutualism. It's not strict mutualism. At the end of the day, the Mughal state did have the upper hand because they had a monopoly on violence. But largely speaking, I would say that this phase was mutualistic in their relations. By the mid-17th century, this relationship changes, largely because requirements of the Mughal empire and the household, the royal household, changes. What do I mean by this? By the mid-17th century, we see an increase in princely competition for the throne. We see an increase in brotherly battles for the throne. And these are not innocuous. This is not sort of your average dinner table brotherly banter for some dessert. It's actually extremely violent, and it could actually lead to the loss of life, which actually happens in the Mughal Empire. So in these brotherly tournaments for the war, which Professor Munis Faruqi has written about so eloquently in his book, Princes of the Mughal Empire, which came out in 2012, I use this book as a way to think about my own materials. And my findings support what he says, which is that these battles are extremely sensitive, and any marginal gain in resources could be the difference between life and death, and of course, between not becoming an emperor and becoming an emperor. And so it is in this phase, political commensalism, that I suggest that Javedi wealth becomes targeted for its immediate quality, that it's immediately available, and that political elites benefit from it in very decisive ways where it might not be very clear how the Javedis actually benefited from it. So political commensalism is just a way of suggesting that this wealth becomes identified by political elites as a very timely resource in Mughal high-level politics. Third phase is expedient extortion, which is where the fortunes of the empire and really of the governors and princes involved change so drastically. The backstory, without going into so much detail, is that the Deccan Wars drains the Mughal treasury of its wealth, and governors in the locality are becoming increasingly desperate for resources. I suggest in the book that their tenures as governors is also becoming longer and longer, which is a symptom of administrative weakness, not strength. And in this process, they identified Javeri wealth initially by asking politely, and then when they are refused, turning to tools of violence to extort this money from members of the Javeri household. This includes leather beatings, imprisonment, torture, and many other forms of extortion that are quite graphic and described in vivid detail in the local sources. For their part, the Javeris are not entirely innocent. I would be remiss to suggest that. They are also hedging their bets as entrepreneurs, as political financiers, are trying to understand the landscape that is evolving and unfolding in their immediate surroundings, and they hedge their bets by funding rival governors who are fighting for the same province. So they're hoping, much like contemporary business elites do, by funding both sides, perhaps they will still come out on top, regardless of who wins any local tournaments for power. The final phase, I suggest, is what I'm calling competitive coparcenary, and that phase is almost a culmination of the first three phases. It is largely a phase in which I document money and the idea of future revenues and contractual relations becoming the basis on which political power is arbitrated and brokered. And these family businesses, both old ones like the Javeris and new ones like the Hari Bhaktis, who I mentioned in the book, really identify finance as a way to help political aspirants sort out the complex tapestry that is the range of resources that are available in the subcontinent. Now, the ultimate master in this particular world of competitive coparcenary are early officials of the East India Company who also see this as a beautiful opportunity. I'm using beautiful in quotes, but really as a strategic opportunity to demilitarize the subcontinent and for their own purposes, set up small fiefdoms in princely states, which then become indebted to them as ultimate masters of this particular competitive environment. So contrary to what people might think, yes, the British were extremely competitive in terms of their military capacities, but really it was identifying indigenous finance and identifying these relationships and essentially using them, leveraging them for their own benefit. That is really where their mastery lied in terms of seeing this complex tapestry.
Thank you for that. That really fleshed out everything and was really helpful. And you really spoke about your arguments very clearly and focusing in on the local too. Like, I think that's one strength of your book. You're able to actually show such a complex and intricate social history on the ground. And a lot of this has to do from the complex and diverse multilingual sources that you use. Can you talk about the sources that you use in this text?
Yes. Yeah, so I actually began studying languages for the love of languages. As I mentioned, I started with Hindi and Urdu at UC Berkeley. And then eventually I acquired Persian skills and Gujarati as well, and a little bit of Marathi, although I would say my Marathi is probably very rusty by now. But what I learned in the process of acquiring language skills is there are a range of materials that are available on the ground that we must be attuned to. So as I began this project, it wasn't in any central repository that I found a bunch of materials pertaining to the Javeri family. I wish that was the case, but that is certainly not what happened. What ended up happening was a combination of fieldwork, library visits, archival visits, and poking into kind of the local scene in terms of where materials are found. That's really where I found a range of materials. So right from Persian diaries to Sanskrit praise poems, to shlokas and pavadas, which are genres of literary writing in Gujarati. This is sort of what animates the book across its chapters. And I was very fortunate to find the role of this family described in some of this material in highly descriptive literary nature, naturally, but also very suggestive of the kind of relationships this family had with nodes of political power. To give you one concrete example, I examine a prashasti, which is called Chintamani Prashasti, which is a praise poem commemorating the building of a Jain temple in Ahmedabad, one that was later destroyed by Aurangzeb. So we actually don't have any physical remains of this temple. All we have are this particular praise poem. And in this praise poem, courtly mutualism comes out in quite clear terms. This poem speaks about the Javeri's relationship with Shah Jahan and the Mughal court, and the kind of gifts that were exchanged between the court and Shantidas's own household dominion in the province. Now, that's just one example, but I can give you several other examples, and the book does that as well. I won't go into so much detail, but the point I want to make is that sometimes when you're working on a geography like India, and you're doing something like quote-unquote economic history, you may find your answer not in numerical values or some kind of archive that is centralized, but in the range and diversity of literary materials that animate the subcontinent on the ground, which is why I believe strongly in not only language learning, but also historical fieldwork. You have to go and live and spend 2 or 3 years in these places because you just don't know where these materials might come from.
Exactly.
That's, yeah, this, the range of materials is incredible. And it gives, it also, I feel, gave the book a different kind of flavor for where, as opposed to expecting a book on centralized or decentralized debates on the state. And then it just, it moving to different registers of sources kind of also changes the way one analyzes the state. And I think on this note, it's a nice segue to talk about, continue the conversation on the structure of state. And I wonder if you could shed a little light on the evolution of state and sovereignty, both in terms of your discussions of Mercantile community. And I mentioned this because the stages and evolution of merchant state relationship seems to reflect a different trajectory of the state structure, not only in early modern South Asia, but I'd like to bring in South Asia in general. And there's an element, and if you want to bring out things that you're teaching about, that would also work great. And I'd like to hear a little more, on this evolution of state and sovereignty, where at a point from having a situation when the Mughal state kind of consolidates itself through merchants, we look at a phase where the aura of the state is, it's grappling to hold on to an aura, right? And then we have, and the state moves on. So yeah, could you just throw some light on this?
Sure. So a good place to start is to think about the kind of state that the Mughal empire was. And in my understanding, and of course, different scholars would have a different perspective on this, so don't take what I say as absolute truth, but it's really largely perspective. My understanding of the Mughal state is a state that has a kind of patrimonial authority to it, which is to say that the role of the emperor himself and those of the extended royal household is very much important to animating how bureaucrats and those in the locality imagine what the state actually is. So when you start thinking about something like a governor, who's a provincial governor, they are rotated every two and a half years. But even though they're bureaucratized and administrative in their day-to-day operations, their allegiance is really to the emperor as someone who has a kind of divine right to rule and organize, and someone who has a divine right to the resources that emanate from empire. Now, what ends up happening is that in the 17th century, the Mughal Empire comes into contact with new ideas and new technologies of rule as well. And the biggest technology is that of money. So right from about 1600 onward, you start seeing the influx of gold and much more in silver with the coming of various European trading companies, the Dutch, the French, and especially the East India Company, which is trading by this point across its, the Mughal Empire's various important ports. Initially, these Europeans ask the state or the emperor for permission to trade, and they're granted this permission. And as they partake in buying and selling of goods, the emperor and the empire really starts to benefit from the influx of all these resources as well. So right from local level manufacturers to the state itself in terms of the kind of revenues it's able to harness is quite large. So it is during this century that you start seeing not only Jahangir, but really Shah Jahan by the mid-17th century being able to spend and expend large sums of money, not only harnessed from agrarian revenues, but also from various levies at the port. Now, as a state expands, one would imagine that it also grows the kind of political tools that it needs to not only grow the pie, but also be able to distribute that pie to a larger number of people. And in the case of the Mughal Empire, one could argue this was its central failing, that as it expanded, as it grew, it wasn't able to generate the kind of nuanced tools politically it needed to be able to not only adjudicate claims between smaller nodes who were seeking a part of that pie, but also how to redistribute the largesse that it was able to harness and generate. So I argue in the book that this was probably its largest shortfall. And as existing groups wanted to be a part of empire and started to sort of grapple with all the resources that it was able to generate, initially, they wanted to partake. But when they were denied this, people like Shivaji Maharaj, for example, in the Deccan, they sought to carve out their own independent domains. And they did this by capitalizing on fissures that were emerging within the Mughal state itself. So the book argues for the Deccan as being a monumental moment where it really tipped the fortunes of the state and really kind of gave new aspirants to power a way into this world. This also meant that existing Mughal administrators, such as governors, for example, also were caught between allegiance to a decaying Mughal emperor and his administration and defecting from it and carving out their own fiefdoms. So in many successful cases, people carved out their own independent domains. The Nizam of Hyderabad is one example. The Nawabs of Cambay and Junagadh are another example. These are all people who I would argue were almost accidental kings or almost accidental emperors in their way, because they were very much committed to the Mughal modality of power, but also realized that it was a sinking ship. So they were caught between wanting it to survive and being a part of it, but also realizing very much that this is a no-go and we have to find our own way forward. In this whirlwind of political decay and really new tools being desired by the market, bankers and local financiers emerge as really key in being able to arbitrate between these folks. And as more and more people wanted a piece of the pie, as I mentioned, they realized that debt relations or borrowing money and being indebted to one another contractually would be a great way to organize and arbitrate resources at a very, very local level. So to give you some kind of contrasting perspective, initially, the governor would harness surplus from the locality. A part of that would be funneled to the emperor's court. And more or less, that was sort of how the Mughal Empire harnessed its revenue. But now imagine a society where many more people at the local level, including village headmen, for example, want a piece of the pie and have a right to that piece of the pie. And so how do you negotiate that? And so these bankers come in and say, look, how about we do short-term contracts with local nodes of power, and we will provide the financial advance that is needed for this deal to go through. Now, it's a different story altogether that bankers lost out in this in the long run. By the 19th century, they were not repaid any money that they were promised, either by the colonial state or by local state power, such as the Gaikwads of Baroda, and they ended up essentially bankrupt themselves. So it was a gamble that did not pay off. And this part of South Asian history has been written about quite beautifully by Ritu Birla in her book on the 19th and early 20th century, is, you know, what are the forms that colonial disciplining of local bankers, what forms did that take, right? And she argues that the legal apparatus of the state became really the admonishing arm to discipline indigenous banking practices. So my world is a bit earlier, but it connects very nicely to what she has to say. In all of this, the big question that you asked was about state power, and the punchline is sort of this, that the Mughal emperor and his administrative apparatus was largely fiscally solvent. They were able to pay the debts that they were able to, that they acquired. And we have evidence of emperors paying off debts of their administrators and so on and so forth. What shifts is that when the Mughal state could have and should have developed technologies for fiat currency and book money, they did not do that. And other aspirants to power, either purposely or inadvertently, identified book money as a way to organize political power. So you start seeing the birth of debt states in the 18th century, including the Gaikwads, for example, who are fiscally insolvent. They're not able to pay their debts, let alone buy a cup of ghee for their household. They're reliant on bankers for all of these purchases, big and small, and they accumulate huge amounts of debt in the process. It is this debt that becomes the alibi of the early East India Company to come in and essentially take over the subcontinent and to reorganize these relations at a meta level. To say that, look, native finances are extremely poor, and because you can't pay these debts back, you give us the land that is hereditarily yours, and we will use that as collateral to help settle all the debts in the subcontinent. So this is the master strategy. And what you end up having really by the 19th and even 20th and 21st century are stronger forms of state power which are indebted. You know, the idea of having sovereign debt is something we take for granted now, but it wasn't so in the 17th and early 18th century.
Thank you. And this is a great segue because there's a major shift in the 18th century into the 19th century, as you were saying, talking about how these become essentially debt states. And essentially, Mughal administration and then eventually the Gaikwad state is reliant on private financiers to finance the state. Can you explain a little bit how we got here and when, and for instance, what that looks like on the ground? Because you describe this period as expedient extortion before at first, and then it yes. shifts. Can you explain that a little bit more in detail?
Yes. So the local level sources speak to revenue farming. Ijara is the word that's used in Farsi and Gujarati also, and Marathi, by the way. So there's a kind of convergence in terminology, especially when it comes to administrative matters. And others have written about this also. Muzaffar Alam has written about this in the case of Awadh and Punjab. Farhat Hassan has written a bit about this. And a few other scholars have pointed to this. But in my work, I look at revenue farming as the local level mechanism through which you get a shift from a fiscally solvent state to one where debt relations starts to become the modality through which power is organized. And as I mentioned, this is not entirely intentional. This actually emerges as a stopgap solution to lack of finance. So when governors in the 1720s and 30s in Gujarat, for example, are desperate for money, and that money is not forthcoming from the emperor himself, what do? They're in the locality and they say, okay, well, what's the quickest way to raise money? How about I give Patan or the port of Cambay or this other town on a revenue farm to anyone in the locality who's willing to pay me 5 years of advance for the right to farm those revenues? And this begins the process by which bankers and local aspirants to power start accumulating revenue farms in their portfolio. And they do this through the advanced capital provided by local bankers like the Javedis, who are promised repayment on those loans over the next 5 years when revenues are realized from these localities. So revenue farming emerges as a stopgap solution to raise quick finance, but then transforms as the primary mode or the primary modality through which a state is able to build its capacity. So the Gaikwads of Baroda, for example, their entire statecraft at the beginning, at the outset, is based on revenue farming. And because they have hereditary claim on certain plots of land, people are willing to recognize those hereditary claims, even though they're not necessarily backed by any strong military might or any strong, robust revenue-generating mechanism. You might be thinking, how is this possible? And I think one of the great unresolved questions still is, how does sovereignty actually work? You know, the sticky substance of being powerful and people having allegiance to you when you don't necessarily have the financial mechanisms to back that sovereignty is a great mystery to me. And I see this in the case of the Mughal Empire, the emperor himself, which is, even though the Mughal emperor and his administration is in decline by the early 18th century, those in the locality are very well aware of this, but are still not willing to give up the titles associated with Mughal power. They still want to be called a Subadar or a Naib-i-Nazim or a Wazir and so on and so forth. And so these terms are extremely latent with meaning. And even though the empire is on its way out, people still want to associate themselves with it. So the 18th century is really a century where political ideas are in a flux, but the trappings of sovereignty are very much intact, and people are really just trying to hedge their bets and figure out which horse they should, you know, sort of latch their cart onto. And this is what emerges in Gujarat itself. But as far as the basic question you asked about the mechanisms of this, revenue farming becomes the strategy through which political power undergoes a major transformation in the 18th century. And this continues well into the 19th century as well.
That is a fascinating, also and a perfect moment to talk about extra-economic relations. And on this note, I'm wondering, you kind of discuss how the merchant-state relationship in the book was more than the circulation of money or exchange values. And it's an aspect of sovereignty kind of just like moving into the section. And I'm wondering, and this comes out in the chapters about extra economic, about the households, about gifts, that there's a whole circulation of economy of circulation, that the semiotics of circulation. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? And it might seem that the book is an economic history, a business history, but it's a lot more than that, right?
Yes. So kind of linked to what I was saying earlier, what I've learned in the process that of studying these kind of business households over time, that at least in the case of Gujarat and in the case of Ahmedabad and Baroda, where I do a lot of my work, it seems that business elites were tied to nodes of power, not just in terms of buying and selling of commodities or being paid X amount of interest on a particular loan. There was real advantage socially and culturally to be seen to be involved with political elites of the day. And so in many cases, they extended bad loans or they made gross miscalculations, really, because they were much more caught up in the stickiness that is sovereignty. And they wanted to be seen alongside sources of political power. And the case is true with the Hari Bhaktis as well. By the late 18th and early 19th century, they realized that they're not going to be paid back any of the money that they were promised by the Gaikwad state. And still, they're in colonial courts reminiscing about how close they were to the Gaikwads, how close they were to sources of political power, how they laid out their capital so that people in power could use it in whatever way that they wanted to. So what I found over time is that, you know, it's really, really hard to kind of pinpoint strict financial relations as the single determining factor. But how do you really get at a group of individuals whose relationship is changing over time? And the best way to kind of trace this change is through the kinds of exchanges that are taking place. To give you one interesting anecdote, the oral history of the family, the Javeri family, suggests that members of the Mughal household referred to Shantidas as Mama, which is, you know, a maternal uncle. Now, how true this is in the historical record is TBD, but The fact that the family is recalling this fondly just tells you the kind of relationship that they would have liked to imagine their ancestors had with sources of political power. And the same is true of the Haribhakti family as well. They're still close to the Gaikwad state, and they still reminisce about the relationship that they had with sources of political power. So this is one aspect which I don't think I did so well in the book, but I really tried my best to kind of bring out certain aspects of it. I think it's for future generations to kind of work on further, to think about the stickiness of sovereignty, so to speak, and kind of how does that manifest in the locality? And do we have the right vocabulary to even talk about that? And that's something I hope that this book at least sparks in terms of discussion and debate.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And I think it's just, it's fascinating because you're able to really flesh out this transition of financiers so clearly. And if you don't mind, since we're on this kind of this transition already, would you talk a little bit more about how the Haribhakti firm came into more political roles during the Gaikwad state, since we're already talking about them as well? How did they transition from financiers to, for instance, people in the political regime?
That's a really good question. So as I talked about earlier, that Akbar's conquest of Gujarat created a kind of pull, a centripetal pull to Ahmedabad. Similarly, when the Gaikwad established their authority in the mid-18th century and Baroda became their capital, the city became a sort of node around which you had various kinds of accumulation. So capital, ideas, people, entrepreneurship, etc. The Haribhakti family emerges from a small town called Mandodhar, which is not too far from Baroda, as a small farming family. But the father, the patriarch, Lakshmidas, he ends up taking a small bit of capital and moving to Baroda, which then his sons later capitalize on to build a banking firm on. Now, they emerge initially as people partaking in the revenue farming schema of the Gaikwad state. And initially, over time, because they are the wealthiest of the bankers in the locality, are identified by the Gaikwad as the chief treasurer or the portdar of the Gaikwad state. So their position gets formalized in the initial Gaikwad administration, but don't let that fool you. That's largely because the Gaikwad state is insolvent and is not able to pay their debts, and they need a strong banking family to kind of manage their administrative and monetary affairs. It is also a situation where there is bribery and kickbacks. So for every dollar, as an example I'm giving you, that the Haribhakti spends on behalf of the Gaikwad state, from everything from buying, like I said, clarified butter to paying off soldiers, they credit back to their own account something like 1.25. So in a way, they're generating profits on the books, but this profit is not really backed by any robust income. And so for about a period of 5 to 15 years, between let's say 1790s and about 1810s, you start seeing the growth of this money and really the growing indebtedness of the Gaikwad state. And it is this level of debt which reaches several huge amounts, like in the crores, right? 13 to 15 crore rupees, that the East India Company initially comes in and says, okay, you are totally insolvent and you're not able to pay your debts. Let us help you resolve this matter by taking control of the lands that you own. So they become kind of princely subordinates of the East India Company, but it is largely through this growing indebtedness. And the financial mismanagement of native states is something worth thinking about, and that's something I document in my book, at least for the Gaikwads. I know there's a lot of new literature around the princely states and whether they were really figments of anyone's imagination and that they actually had robust authority. I'm not denying the fact that they had some semblance of local authority, but we cannot forget that at least in the case of Baroda, they were financially in disarray. And it is this disarray that becomes the pretext for the colonial takeover of their authority.
That's a fantastic arc of things coming into shape. So I have to say that we are almost out of time. So we'll begin kind of zooming out. And I'd like to ask with the scholarship, with the kind of field on merchant-state relationship. And you mentioned the Medici of Europe and the Rothschilds of Britain and the kinds of archives. Within all this, you've placed the evolution, the state, and the people in it. What would you tell our readers about this fascinating field of study?
It's a very, very good question. I believe that if you think about the history of capitalism more broadly, we have robust stories and narratives for why a capitalist mode of production, the rationalization of labor, the growth of financial capital, etc., emerges in Western Europe. And that's largely because we have robust archives to tell the story, both from the state's perspective, but also from that of financial specialist perspective. To give you an anecdote, the University of Pennsylvania, where I teach, every year I take my students to look at a range of logbooks produced by the Medici family. And we have hundreds of them here at the University of Pennsylvania alone, let alone what might exist out there in the world. So we have this material to talk about the kind of financial practices and the kind of sophisticated nature of their banking activities. We're tempted to say that for other parts of the world, such levels of sophistication did not exist. And what I'm trying to suggest in my work is that that judgment might be premature and a little misplaced. We ought to take a step back and, first of all, recognize that the kind of archival material that we may hope for just does not exist in South Asia. So that should not deter us. That should actually inspire us and say, okay, what are some other ways that I might be able to access this question or these range of questions? Or can I ask new questions altogether that might not be sort of prescriptive and drawn from existing historiographies? So what I would like people to take away from this is materials exist, but they might just be of a different kind, and they might be of a different magnitude, and they might require a few extra months of field work and research. But they do exist, and really going to spend time in the localities and seeing what you can harness is really, really worth the effort. At least in my case, I would have never imagined that I could tell the story that I told at the outset. It was only by spending years in the field and being really agnostic in terms of who I am as a scholar and the kind of questions I want to ask, believe it or not. You have to kind of go in a bit open-minded. I didn't know I was a business historian until I got my first job, to be entirely honest. It was at the end of the writing process, at the end of submitting a dissertation, when a range of more thoughtful and more experienced scholars looked at me and said, "Wow, you're a business historian, or you work on the history of capital." And I thought to myself, "All right, that sounds wonderful. Thank you." And I move forward, right? So what I'm trying to say is that resist the urge to mark yourself as person A or person B. Do it only when you absolutely have to, i.e., when you're looking for a job. That's sort of as blunt as I can be. And being agnostic is, I think, the real beauty of being a student. And even now, when I think about my next project, where I think about the kind of work I want to do, I'm very agnostic in that. And I'm inspired by my professors, especially at JNU, who were extremely diverse in the kind of materials they researched and published. You'd be really hard pressed to pigeonhole them as a historian of A, B, or C. And so that's the beauty of working on South Asia. And I think people in the field are both forgiving and also encouraging in that respect. So be pluralistic, be agnostic, and learn your languages, because this is really the best way into the world of new materials in South Asia. I've only scratched the tip of the iceberg, but I think there's a lot more material out there. And I'd be more than willing to share what I learned and where existing materials are for those that might be interested in the audience.
Thank you. I think as emerging scholars, we love hearing that. It gives us such hope for the future of South Asian studies, especially. Well, we're about to wrap up, and we have one final question. And this is just we wanted to really think about what is the legacy of some of these financial practices and relationships we talked about, whether it's the Hari Bhakti firm or the Javeris. What can you tell us about the legacy of them today? in Gujarat.
So before I say something specific about the two families, let me just say, broadly speaking, we live in a moment where private capital and business elites are in the business, so to speak, of shaping, transforming, you might even say interfering, or you might say being opportunistic in terms of the political climates that they operate in. And we as a society have to be aware that capital has been involved in state power, at least in South Asia, since the Mughal Empire, if not before, and that's not new. What is new is that we live in a world that is supposed to be a democracy, a world where people are supposed to have a say in the kind of governments that represent them. And so we have to be especially careful in terms of the role that private capital is playing in shaping political power and being involved in the political process itself. We have recent discussions in India about the role of electoral bonds. We know that those who are aspiring to win elections rely on private capital resources, including commercial jets, helicopters, buildings, capital, you know, infrastructure that private elites are providing those who are trying to win elections, and so on and so forth. So I'm going to say that that's not new, but it's significant and it can be problematic in the world that we live in, because we're supposed to live in a world where people are supposed to vote for those who should represent them, and this should be done on merit. It should be done on the basis of ideas. So we have to be careful about that, and that's something that I think is a trend we should be aware of. Now, as far as the families themselves, the Jhaveri family is now running the Arvind Group, which is one of India's largest manufacturers of textiles, as I mentioned. They are a global conglomerate. They are involved in new ventures in real estate and technical textiles, including fire retardant outerwear, carbon fiber of the airplanes that we fly in, and so on and so forth. They are extremely honest in the sense that, you know, I've met them briefly, and when I told them I'm working on their family, they said, please let us know what you learn, no matter what it is. So in that sense, they're open to learning about their family's history, which I commend them on. And I hope they continue thriving, because they allow us to see history in a much more dynamic fashion. So I've only focused on the first four or five generations of the family, but the rest of the family still remains. And that might be a book worth writing, either by me or by someone else in the audience. The Hari Bhakti family, unfortunately, went bankrupt in the 19th century, but the family still survives, albeit in a completely new fashion. So you could say that their family experienced rupture, but they are now involved in accounting enterprises and IT work in Baroda and across the country, more broadly speaking. So, you know, they're around, and as good entrepreneurs, they have continued to survive despite challenges along the way. I will say finally that family enterprise is some of the most interesting in our times, because, like I said, they really allow you to see history in a much more dynamic fashion. So for anyone who's out there looking for a project, family history and family entrepreneurship might be a fruitful way to start exploring broader questions in South Asian history.
Thank you. Well, I think we've reached the end of the interview. So thank you, Sudev, for your time. Thanks, Brittany. And I would urge our listeners to go pick up the book. It's a fascinating read. So on that note, thank you and bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.